second half of the parak. The fourth parak begins with a topic which has importance in the area of ribbis also, as the Gemara makes reference to in the first Amud, or the first daf rather. And that is defining what is cash and what is a commodity. The reason the Mishnah is concerned is because we need to define one vis-a-vis the other in terms of what creates a transaction and what makes the transaction final. So it is a machlokus in the Gemara in general, which the Gemara is going to quote later on, as to what is the real engine of the kinyan. Is it mos or is it mashicha? So if somebody buys something, you have the buyer and the seller. So the buyer is going to give money and the seller is going to give an item. It may or may not happen at the same time. And it's not always clear which one's going to happen first. So at what point does the sale become final? So what our Mishnah premises itself on is the idea that you need mashicha. You need the item to actually be drawn in, to be taken by the purchaser. So you could come to that conclusion one of two ways. Either you could say that mashicha is the effective kinyan min ha-Torah, or you could say that, no, really, mos konos dvar Torah. That really, min ha-Torah, money, paying for the object, is an effective kinyan. However, Chazal made a gzeira that we should not suffice with that. And the danger is that we're afraid that, let's say, Jonathan wants to sell me something. So I pay him for it in advance, it's still in his house. So who does it belong to? So if we say that I paid for it, so now it's mine, so then we have a risk that Jonathan can come to me tomorrow and say, oh, what a shame, there was a fire in my warehouse, and your item got destroyed. Good thing it was yours and not mine, because now the loss happened to you. So that's a concern that we're afraid of, so we said that the sale shouldn't be final until I actually take the item. Now, as the Gemara points out, what does that mean? He's going to burn it on purpose because it's not his. He's going to say that he burnt it when it was burnt, when it's not really burnt. You know, there's going to be other Yisurim involved anyway. So the Gemara says, no, what we're really afraid of is Tom, there will be a real fire and it won't be his fault, it'll be an accident. But if it was his, he would work hard to get it back. And because it's not his anymore, he's not going to push so hard to get it back. So we don't want that scenario. So we made a din d'rabbanan that mashicha is coming. So there were a couple of issues that came out of that. The machlokas rishonim, first of all, is that therefore the only kinyan when dealing with specifically sales, or what about other ways of transferring property? What about gifts? What about the veda metzia? Are all property acquisitions subject to this rule, or is this a takana specifically when it comes to mamonis? And another major issue that came out is the fact that we have a little bit of ambiguity as to what is really the kinyan min ha-Torah, and what's going to be affected by that is an assumption the Gemara has in Maseches Bechoros based on the Psukim, that whatever one of the two is the kinyan min ha-Torah is the opposite of what's the kinyan when dealing with a non-Jew. That the transactions between Jews and non-Jews don't necessarily work off the same principles, and we have a different method of kinyan for that context. So in general, that's going to be very relevant now. We edged into the time where it's particularly relevant to Halacha L'maisa. Now we are Shloshim Yom Kodem HaPesach. So the question of how to effectively create a kinyan between a Jew and a non-Jew is a highly relevant topic, and one that we actually spent a lot of time on last year. We spent a couple days, I forgot, maybe 2 or 3 days, talking about the sugya of Mechiras Chametz, an endlessly fascinating sugya. So we won't have 2 or 3 days this year, but maybe we'll say a few words on it later on, especially because of its Bav Metzia connections. But there, one of the issues that we have is we have to know what creates a kinyan. The assumption is that, this is an assumption Poskim take for granted, even though you could maybe argue on it a little bit. But that, first of all, just to say a little bit about kinyanim. So what is a kinyan in general? So we have many different types of kinyanim, as we see. We're talking about two here, we all know. It's also a major first parak above Messiah topic. You talk about a kinyan yad, a kinyan chatzar. We have many different kinds of kinyanim in halacha, a kinyan agav, a kinyan kesef, a kinyan shtar, a kinyan situmta. So all of the different kinyanim represent the idea that in order for property to actually transfer, so we need to have some type of gemiras das. That's how the Achronim generally explain that you need some type of physical symbol that there has been an agreement between the two parties, and it's that agreement that allows the item to pass from one party to the other. So we have the ability sometimes to draw on whatever is conventional. It's a situmta. So let's say, for example, if you live somewhere where a handshake is considered to be something that seals the deal. So a handshake takes a form of a kinyan. That's also one of the slots in anything that is considered to be effective in the culture in which you're living. And then there are others that the halacha explicitly recognizes, and some of them are recognized on a level of Minat Torah, and some are recognized on a level of Midrabanan. So it's an interesting question what it means to say something is a kinyan Midrabanan and a kinyan Minat Torah. Does it really matter? So, for example, should we say, as many poskim assume, that if we're dealing with a halacha that's relevant on a level of Minat Torah, so we should insist on a kinyan that's effective in a Torah, that if the halacha is addressing that sphere, so then the kinyan has to be a full-blown kinyan in a Torah, and a kinyan midrabanan is not going to be effective. So that question comes up, especially when dealing with mechiras chametz, because mechiras chametz, so what are we trying to accomplish? We have an iser d'oraisa of bal yiroa bal yimatzeh, and we want to be clear of violating that prohibition. We don't want to be in violation of the Yisra Dereis of Bayiro Bayimatze. So, therefore, the assumption many of the poskim have is that if a kinyan is only effective on a level midrabanan, it's not going to do the job, because you're dealing with an Yisra Dereis. You could quibble with that. You could say, what's the whole concept of a kinyan derabanan mean? Anytime you're dealing with property, by definition, there are all kinds of implications, minatar midrabanan, just in terms of ownership and theft and everything like that. So how does it ever make sense to say you own something midrabanan, you don't own it minatar? Well, how does it have any logic to it to say that there should be such a distinction? Especially also because we have a principle of Hefker Bezdin Hefker, which seems to mean that Chazal have the authority to reassign Mamonos based on how they see fit, which would include all kinds of possible justifications. It's good for society, it's good for Halacha, whatever it is. So therefore, there's a case to be made that if the Kinyan is effective on a level Midrabanan, then that should be effective on a level Minat Torah as well. Thirdly, one could say that if the purpose of a kinyan is to affect gemiras das, is to simply be an expression of the idea that the two parties have decided this is going to show that we're committed and that we're actually making this transaction, so then why don't we simply say that, okay, min ha-Torah, there are some tools that have been provided for that purpose, and Chazal added on tools which serve effectively the same purpose. If that's the kinyan they choose to use between the two of them, so then that should be an effective transaction. So why should it not be within the rights of the two parties, especially since the two parties generally, you know, with the exception of Revisa, generally have the ability to make a transaction between themselves based on whatever terms they want. So if we decide between ourselves, this should be our kinyan. So why should that not be effective on all levels, which is a possible position to take in general. So this is a complex question, this idea that a kinyan derabanan should somehow be only partially effective when dealing with a deraisa. But in any event, the practice is that when it comes to mechiras chametz, so we are particularly concerned about this whole hodgepodge of issues, that we're not sure what is a real kinyan minat Torah, even when it comes to dealing with Jews. It seems like we paskin like this view of Moos Konos, that that maker I didn't, that's true, and it's just there's a takana not to finish the story with that. But that's what it seems like. But there is essentially a question about that, and then the fact that you're dealing with a non-Jewish purchaser, so then it seems to be that it should be the opposite of that. So we have essentially a question. So our practice when it comes to Mechiras Chametz is to try to put in as many kinyanim as possible. So if, I don't know if anyone here, have you ever been present at the Mechiras Chametz? Okay, right, the rabbi's sons in the room may be more likely to have been present in the, at the Mechiras Chametz. There's a minig many of us have here in the New York area to join Rabbi Willig for his Mechiras Chametz in Riverdale. There's 30-something rabbanim who all come into the same room and sell chametz together. So it's worth going once in a while, to see how the transaction takes place. So you see that there are a number of kinyanim that are utilized. We use a contract as a shtar. There is a kinyan sutter, I'll pick up a penknife. There is a kinyan kesef, I'll pay a coin representing a certain amount per person who's being represented in the sale. There's a handshake to represent a situmta. There's a kinyan agav, which means that the property in which the chametz is located is also rented. And the kinyan agav means when you are selling or renting land, so you can also throw movable property in with that sale as well. So many different methods of kinyan are used in order to try to guarantee that the sale is 100% valid. It's also interesting, parenthetically, that what would happen if the sale wasn't valid? Let's say you discovered afterwards, you asked a shaila, you did something for Mechiras Chametz, and you asked a shaila afterwards that maybe my Mechiras Chametz wasn't any good, and it turns out you get a psak tak, it's questionable. So does that necessarily ask the chametz? So if it happens in your life, you should ask the shaila, but there is a case to be made that some achronim had, some sofer, the tshuva, the mas binyamin, that perhaps the attempt to sell it, even if it was an ineffective attempt, may have the halachic status of bittul. So therefore you're essentially, perhaps we should compare it, you know, you're trying to throw something out the window and you think it's open, you don't realize it's closed, so it bounces back into your house. Right? So you thought you sold it, and it came back in. But perhaps the fact that you threw it out the window, that itself is an act of bittul, and after the fact, maybe even if all of these kinyanim that you try turn out not to be effective, even the Raisa Drabanan, there might be a case to be made for that. At that point, you're dealing with a Drabanan, right? Because you attempted to, for the purposes, to own chametz on Pesach is an Isser Daraisa. So certainly you're going to do whatever you can to try to avoid that Isser. But let's say, again, it comes after Pesach, you find out that you learn the sugi then and you realize that there was some shayla, and now the question is, the chametz that you have, is it usur in terms of the din of chametz shavala v'pesach? So there is a case to be made that that's already nesed rabbanan, that's how we assume, that was in machlokis, but we assume l'halacha, that chametz shavala v'pesach is a nesed rabbanan. So there's what to work with in terms of what will be required in terms of that nesed rabbanan. So there is some literature to the effect that someone who tried to sell chametz ineffectively, maybe perhaps that can be viewed as a type of bittul, and therefore that perhaps, and bittul is effective on a level of manat Torah as well anyway, but so if it is indeed bittul, so that would save you from the bali rabbi matzeh as well. But that's a complex issue. Again, if it comes up, you should ask the shaila, but there is a case to be made along those lines. So we have this whole sugya of what exactly qualifies as a kinyan, and what exactly qualifies as a kinyan when dealing with between a Jew and a non-Jew is a sugi here, is a sugi in the beginning of Maseches Bechoros, all addressed essentially in this Mishnah that seems to be telling us that we focus on Mashiach as the kinyan. But why that is, it's a machlokas, either because it's a kinyan, that's what the kinyan is, Manat Torah, or because Chazal made a takana. So then the question also is, so what is the significance of this takana? Does it mean that they have negated the effectiveness of a kinyan kesef? Or should we say that no, the kinyan kesef is still valid in the Torah, it's just that Chazal kind of provided an escape clause. that if the guy should show up the next day and say, oh, bad news, your stuff was burnt in a fire, you could say, well, guess what, I back out of the deal. That you have this ability to get out of it, even though there was on some level an effectiveness. So there is a whole literature about this. There are some very important nafkaminas. Let's say somebody paid for something and with thomos konos, Ma'amina Torah, and then I was Makami Shemisha with it. So do we say that it's not his because Chazal, you know, canceled that kinyan, and the only kinyan that's effective is the kinyan Mashiach? Or do we say, no, that really it is his, it's subject to being reversed later if something happens, but if it turns out that it's not reversed, so then this was actually his the whole time, and he can effectively make a kinyan kedusha. So there is a literature about that based on a Meiri and a Rashi. And then, as just take Rachel's question a second, the Rebbe of Nasi Gishtetner has some shuvas about this. He adds in that maybe you could throw in some extra sveikis, that even if theoretically it could be true, maybe the woman's not going to have gemiras das because she knows that this could get pulled away from her at any moment. So assuming that she has that kind of understanding of what's going on, it's definitely kind of a romantic environment. You know, here will you marry me with this ring, which by the way you should know that I paid for, but I haven't done Mashiachan yet, so theoretically it could be a reversal. So if you tell her this whole story and she has a lack of gemiras das based on it, that would definitely provoke a certain shayla, assuming that that's really the scenario that you're dealing with. Manachem?
Shouldn't the, let's say, so you sell it to a guy, you sell a chametz to a guy, does he have the ability to use that chametz?
Yes, except he has to pay for it. And again, so chametz, I guess we should find some time. I don't know, maybe we'll slip it in today, or maybe next week's an appropriate time for it. Before Pesach, again, last year we spent hours and hours on it. It's a fascinating sugi in general. There's so much to say, so I feel too repetitive to spend all the hours on it, but probably we'll spend some time on it, just because it's too connected to what we're talking about, and it's Pesach time. But, so yes, theoretically he has the right to use it. You have to then understand, though, it's not as, you know, people are afraid of that, so to speak, but it's not so scary, because he'll still have to pay for it. So if he takes your whiskey, it's his. He's certainly no gneva involved. Chalila, it's the other way around. If you use it, it's gneva because it's his. It's not any gezel on his part, but he will ultimately have to pay for it. So it's not as if you're going to. Yeah, you're machnim it. So that's what we see from our sugi in general, and that's an important point to understand the halacha. Hello. A special guest that maybe you remember the discussion last year with Mechiras Chametz. So you're mocking it to him, but that doesn't take away from the fact that you have to pay for it. It's a crucial understanding. Let me spend a second on that because it's a very, very important issue with Mechiras Chametz. That's one issue that's much more crucial actually than what we just said. You know, if you tried to make a kinyan and the kinyan was somehow defective, maybe there's a way around it. But the issue of the payment and what role that plays, in some ways is a little bit more important. That essentially, first of all, it's machlokas haposkim, what a kinyan kesef is. And so if I buy a house with a kinyan kesef, and the house costs $1 million, and I put down a quarter as a kinyan kesef, quarter of a dollar. So what's pshat on that? This is my focus between the Taz and the Sma. That the Taz said that's essentially a down payment. You know, nowadays you'd have a hard time getting away with a down payment like that. It's a far cry from the 20%. But maybe, okay, it's a down payment. I paid a quarter and now I owe $999,999.75. And the Sma says, no, it's not a down payment at all. It's a symbolic payment. It's a transaction that's meant to affect the kinyan, but it's not connected at all to the purchase price, even in this minute amount. It says, what's the raya that's true? That we know that a kinyan kesef is effective for kedushin. It's one of the three kinyanim that is effective to marry a woman. So would you tell me that it's a representation of her value on any level, that this is somehow a down payment towards monetary value that you're putting on a woman? Of course not. So since it doesn't have any connection to the person's value, so it's clear that in the context of Anisha, the Kinyan Kesef that we use, which happens to be out of the three Kinyanim, the one that we actually practice today, so that Kinyan is clearly symbolic in nature, and it's the same Kinyan Kesef in every other area of Halacha, so therefore Mamela, Kinyan Kesef is a symbolic Kinyan. So either way, whether it's symbolic or whether it's a down payment. So what's the status of that extra $999,999? So is it that until that money is paid, you don't own the object? Chas v'shalom. Because if that was true, we'd be in big trouble with mechiras hametz. What it is
he loans you the rest, and then you own it.
Yeah, right. Essentially, it was called zaka for love and milva. That we treat it like a loan. You know that they don't actually have the process of a loan going on, but we view it as a loan. So essentially, if I bought something with this down payment, whatever you want to call it, this initial payment, with this first payment of money, so that transaction makes the object 100% loan. And the fact that I may have 99% of the purchase price left to pay, it's not that I will own it proportionally based on how much I've paid or only at the end. It's that I own it right away. And now I have a debt. I have a debt that obligates me to pay the rest. So I certainly have to pay the rest. It's a debt as valid as any other debt, but it doesn't affect my ownership. Now, Lemaisa, you know, if you don't pay for your furniture, so the store comes and forecloses on it, you don't pay for the rest of your house, the store comes and forecloses on it, what does that represent? So you can get into what that represents. Pashtus, it represents a remedy that the seller has to retake the object if the rest isn't paid, but not that they're taking it because you haven't owned it yet. It was yours fully until they came and retook it. And that they have this ability to claim that object as a exchange for their payment. You're not going to pay for the rest of the couch, so then they have this chus to take it back, but not because it wasn't yours. That's how you'd have to view it halachically. So that's crucial, crucial, crucial for mechiras chametz, because the way it works is, so you sell this purchaser the chametz that's worth very possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars. Certainly the mechiras chametz that takes place in Riverdale, so you have 40 shuls or something represented with hundreds of people in each sometimes. So you're dealing with easily, $1 million of chametz or whatever it is. So the purchaser is not giving you $1 million at that time. He's going to have to pay it later. So we give him a week to pay it. He has till the week, which happens to work out right after Pesach, that he can pay off the rest. Now, so far, in my experience, it never happened that he's actually come and paid the whole rest of $1 million. So what happens? So it's not that the sale gets undone. That would be disastrous for us. It's not that it was never his, because then that would undo everything we're trying to accomplish. It's crucial that he did own the chametz over Pesach. So it was his, and it's irreversibly his. It's his no matter what. It's just that he has this debt of $1 million to pay after Pesach, and we'll give him an option. If you can't come up with $1 million, or for whatever reason if you don't want to pay $1 million, then we'll agree, instead of taking $1 million, we'll take the chametz back. But from then on, not retroactively.
So why does he have to pay for what he eats?
Right, so then, he has to pay for what he... We're agreeing to this deal. We're agreeing to take back everything and let him off the hook, because the mice of the chametz is all still there. But if he's going to actually consume it, and he's not going to be able to give it back to us, so then he owes us the value. If he's not paying his debt, right, he's not paying the purchase price of the chametz, he kept it.
In the furniture situation, if I buy furniture and the payments, and I've caused $20 of wear and tear by sitting on it, well, they don't have a right on that. Like, if I owned it,
they can't collect it, but they probably have gotten some money from you. Right? The fact, it's not going to correlate exactly, but you've probably paid something. But the couch is worth $1,000, right? And you buy it on a payment plan, and you can't finish off paying it, so they take it back. But they take it back, they probably did get paid something for it. You paid a down payment,
In our hypothetical situation, we're dealing only with, like, the way I understand is that you have the chametz is collateral on his loan, all the chametz, and if he doesn't pay back the loan within a week, then the chametz returns.
I wouldn't phrase it exactly like that, because the loan part is a little bit misleading. And so we say zaka for love and milva, essentially we treat it like a debt. There wasn't an actually loan here, it's just that the money that remains for the purchase price is owed. So it's as if you borrowed the money. It's the same way you owe money that you borrowed, so you owe money for this purchase price that you haven't paid yet. In order to distinguish it from the idea that he has yet to purchase the item. He doesn't have to purchase the item. He has a debt, which was the same kind of debt he would have. So I wouldn't use terms like collateral and loan, because it's not really what's happening. But what's happening is that I owe him this money. So now what happens if I stiff him, right? If I choose not to pay the money, so I have the item already. So okay, so maybe we have a mechanism that he should be protected against that, that he can come and take back this item, which is worth the money, essentially, that he is owed. Now your point about the usage I got, now it'll generally be the case that I paid something, because he's not going to give me back my down payment. If he forecloses on my couch, or the bank forecloses on the house, then I can say, well, we took the house, but you paid mortgage for 2 years, we'll give you back the 2 years of mortgage that you paid. So there is going to be some money that went to them for this. It's not going to exactly match what the wear and tear is, but it's not that they're getting...
I don't know how it really does. Let's say that the good pays $20, and he comes to your ass, eats $5 worth of Hummus. So you would get some of the money from Roto Willig?
Presumably you wouldn't get any money, and presumably he would have to pay for what he ate. The money that he paid so far, especially if we follow the SMA, he essentially hasn't really paid any of the purchase price. Right, because he's in that circumstance, different than the couch circumstance where you will have paid something. But in the case of the Chametz, he hasn't really paid anything because the coins that he's given are symbolic. If you follow the SMA, right, the coin is not...
I don't understand how we're saying that he owns it fully.
Correct.
But yet he has to pay in order to eat it. I feel like
right, because true. because essentially he has a debt that he has to pay.
But shouldn't that
if
not
he
be
wants
that,
to keep
if,
it?
If we're treating it as a separate debt, shouldn't that be set that he owns the Chametz, he can do it for what he wants? But you just have to pay for it within a week.
Morally, if you plan on keeping something, you have the debt that you have to pay of the purchase price. Now, if you don't pay the purchase price, so we have to figure out how we're going to appease the seller who doesn't get his purchase price money. But the fact is that if you are going to give back the whole thing, okay, so then that's one thing. But if you give back part of it and keep it, so certainly on a moral level, it makes sense to pay for the part that you're keeping. So, you know, the idea that he's able to eat your property, that seems a little bit daunting to people, but certainly for many halakha reasons it shouldn't be daunting, because again, that's the whole point, that we want it to really be his. And also, it's not as if you're risking money, because you're risking the chametz, but you should be ready to risk the chametz. That's the least we should expect from you in terms of body or rabbi, you might say. And then it's not like if you're going to go bankrupt over it, because whatever he decides to keep, he's going to have to pay for. Menachem?
Who would agree to do this?
We've seen through history that many people.
I know, they agree
right,
to do it,
always
but how do you explain to them?
Right,
how
so it's
sound like a joke, and then that's.
So okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, how does it work? It works obviously in different ways because people, you know, throughout the world at any given moment, every shul
right,
has it's not even just Orthodox shuls either. You know, definitely conservative, you know, definitely hundreds and thousands of shuls across the world in every generation for the past several hundred years have found somebody. So how do they find people? So, you're usually connected to somebody who you trust in some context, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's somebody who works in the shul, and they feel that it's a privilege to be a part of this ritual. I know that in Riverdale, that's the case. He's happy to help out his friend of a Willig. In the case of Riverdale, so the person who's involved is a businessman, I believe it's a real estate agent, which is preferable for at least two reasons. One reason is he's somebody who is skilled and knowledgeable in transactions, and so it makes it all the more real in that sense. And also, because he's a businessman, in theory, if he wants to keep all the chametz, he could probably find a way to raise the capital to do it. So it's not as if we're selling it to somebody who it would be impossible for him to find a way to hold on to all this chametz. So those are advantages. And you know, when you've been doing it more than 1 year already, and nothing terrible happens to him because he's purchased the chametz, so it's that also helps. What we'll do is, I guess, since we're end up focusing on this topic, I'll just take a moment to explain philosophically what I believe about this topic and why I think that despite the fact that it's often vilified and looked at as a joke both from within and without, do you want me to take the question first? Or?
afterwards.
Okay, so what I believe to be the philosophical underpinnings of Mechiras Chametz, I don't think it's actually whatever is actually explained, although I think it's a fine explanation, but I don't think it's what actually is told to the purchaser, but definitely I think it's a fine thing to explain, because I think this is the case. That in general, we're skipping over the issue a little bit, but it's been a debate halachically over the generations whether this is an appropriate mechanism or not. It's not an appropriate, it's not something that we find explicitly in the Talmud. We find models that are close to it in Maseches Bechoros, where this whole sugi comes up about the kinyan, based on our Gemara, is the kinyan that works for a non-Jew. So there, the issue is that the Gemara talks about selling a Bechor, that if a person has an animal that's called a Behema HaMevakeres, you have an animal that's about to give birth to a Bechor. So in current times, so we have a big issue then. It's a kind of a lose-lose situation because the animal is going to be kadosh, but there's nothing you can do with a kadosh animal. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash to deal with it. So what do you deal with? What do you do if you have such a situation? It's really a halachic problem. So we are therefore instructed to try to avoid the situation. So if an animal is owned in shutfus between a Jew and a non-Jew, so the child doesn't have kedushas bechor. So it's recommended that you sell part of the animal to a non-Jew before the Bechor is born, so you won't have to deal with this issue of Kedushas Bechor. So that's a little bit of a precedent for Mechiras Chametz, but it's clearly different than Mechiras Chametz because it doesn't have Mechiras Chametz theoretically. We don't feel we necessarily have to do. Here we have it depends on the circumstance, but certainly not to this degree. Here you have a halachic problem that has no solution. There's nothing else you can do, so better you should sell it and avoid the whole problem rather than have an animal that's kodesh and you can't end up doing anything with it. So that's a semi-precedent. There is a tosefta, which says that if a person is on a boat with a non-Jewish co-traveler and he realizes that Pesach is upon him and he has chametz with him on the boat, so then he can transfer the ownership of the chametz to this non-Jew for the duration of Pesach and get it back. So that Tosefta clearly is a much closer model to the Mechiras Chametz that we have. The difference is, as all those Svarim point out, that it has very much the tone of a kind of last-minute accident, that you were on a boat and you got stuck on the boat longer than you thought, and you have merchandise that you weren't able to sell, and it's your business, and you kind of got stuck, and it's a one-time thing, one person to another. So then that's where you have this mechanism utilized. What we have today is that it's built into our schedules month in advance that everyone will come and do a Mechiras Chametz. The whole community is going to sell Chametz as a matter of course. Clearly is a much different degree than what's presented in the Tosefta, and it's been a topic of a lot of debate. And a lot of the questions that are asked, essentially, is this a harama? Is this a way to get out of the halacha? Is this an evasion, etc.? And essentially the questions you've been asking, so is it ever going to be the case that the purchaser is actually going to utilize the chametz? And isn't it always the case in our memory that he always ends up giving the whole thing back afterwards anyway? So is the sale real? And you may have heard the joke, some of the jokes that come out of this, say that the Orthodox rabbis decided that smoking is prohibited, but the Jews aren't worried, they'll just sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So we all realize that that's not going to be effective. So the question is, why not? So how come we have certain mechanisms, certain areas where selling is effective, and other areas where it doesn't seem to be effective? What's the difference between one and the other? And in between, it's a major, major controversy, which is not our topic today, and I'm not taking a side, I just want to illustrate a little bit some of the differences. So the mechanism of the Hetem Mechira, which is utilized in Eretz Yisrael and it continues to be a new controversy every 7 years because it's also very circumstantial. It was a raging controversy when it was first suggested, and the controversy has never abated. And it also gets new fire because a lot of it is dependent on whether it's appropriate or not, depends on certain circumstances. Circumstances are always changing, and whatever the circumstances are, half the people say this is all the more reason why we need to do Hashem Bechira. On the other hand, says all the more reason why Hashem Bechira is a terrible thing, and continues to be controversial from beginning to end. But there, the premise is that if one sells land in Eretz Yisrael to a non-Jew, then it won't be subject to the prohibitions of Shemitah, and it can continue to be worked during the Shemitah year. So that is highly kind of, not taking aside the controversy, that's also a topic we could easily speak about for hours and hours, and that's more to today. But it's interesting to note that for most considerations, that is less controversial. I'm sorry, for most perspectives, that is much more controversial, much more problematic than the theory of science. Why? One huge reason, which is a whole separate topic, is whether it's even mutter to do. Is it mutter to sell land in Eretz Yisrael? Is that a violation of the Isser of Lo Sechanim? That's one of the major, major reasons why it's opposed. So that's a completely external consideration that doesn't carry over to Chametz. But leaving that aside, and it's very hard to leave that aside in the Shemitah issue because it's huge, but leaving that aside, there are other problems with the sale that undermine the seriousness of the sale. First of all, and these are really points which come out differently in the context of Mechiras Chametz, you call that a harama, you call that an evasion of the law, it's easy to see why. Right? The Torah says, don't work the land in Shemitah, and you're doing the sale, and the result is you will work the land in Shemitah. So essentially, it's an evasion of what the Torah has commanded. Whether it's justifiable is a different question, but it's essentially an evasion. While here, the Torah says, don't own chametz, and this is a way of not owning chametz. Is it a fully effective way of not owning chametz? Does it really address what we think the Torah has in mind? You know, maybe we assume the Torah means don't have any connection to it at all, and here we're maintaining a connection, but we are... just temporarily not owning it, so you can question whether it rises to the threshold of what the Torah is asking, but it's not the opposite of what the Torah is telling us to do. So it's not a harama from that angle. A second major difference is that over the course, at least over the course of Pesach itself, you will have nothing to do with this chametz. I mean, for this purpose, we're addressing balabatim, who are not supermarket owners, or factory owners, but the average person who's just a normal consumer of chametz. So during the course of that week, he will lock it up and it will be in his basement under taped closed doors, and he will indeed not interact with that chametz during the course of Pesach, while the land will actually be cultivated on behalf of this owner during the course of the Shemitah. That's also a huge difference in terms of how genuine it is. But also one of the major, major factors that differentiates it too, which is also relevant to what Menachem was saying. This is a third very, very significant, probably game-changing difference between the two. Is so let's say the purchaser would say, I want to take your chametz. I decided I want it. I'm gonna eat your chametz, or I want to keep it, and I'll write you a check for the value of the chametz. So presumably we'd be okay with that. We don't want to take the financial loss of throwing all our chametz into the fire. But if you'll actually keep it and pay us for it, all right, you know, fine, we'll have to go shopping again. It's a tircha, but we'd accept that. What would happen if the Arab purchaser would say, listen, I'm interested in keeping the land of Israel, so here's a check for $1 billion. So how would we feel about that? So hopefully we would not be so happy about that, and we wouldn't accept it. So that also really calls into question just how genuine the sale is. In contrast, again, to chametz, that when it comes to chametz, if the guy says, listen, I'm really ready to pay, so then, okay, if he calls our bluff, call it. We're ready to accept the check, and you can keep the chametz. And that's why it is important that we make it available for that purpose. So part of what we do is we give the keys, or we at least make clear how the keys can be accessed, and we give the address. We try to identify where the chametz is as much as possible, with the understanding that should he choose to avail himself of the chametz, then he certainly has the physical possibility of doing so, and he has the legal right to do so, because it's his. So what does all of this accomplish for us? So does it mean that this is essentially a joke? There are those who said that it's, even if we rely on it, we shouldn't rely on it for real chametz d'oraisa, that maybe only for taruvas chametz, or for other types of chametz derivatives, but for real bread, we won't use it because we're not comfortable with it. there was a case that was made, the Bechor Shor, that maybe all the chametz is drabbanan because you also do bittul, so bittul is effective on a level of minat Torah. Many others called that into question because they said, how could you say bittul is effective? It's not the same chametz. The chametz that you're mevatel is the chametz you think you're never going to see again, the chametz that crumbs under the couch. The chametz that you're selling and doing business with, you're not mevatel that chametz. Two different tracks. So how can you say that it's only a drabbanan because you're mevatel chametz? That's the whole discussion. But the point is, that's part of the literature. Do we say it's effective only for drabbanans? Or do we say it's not effective at all? Do we say it's effective even on a level of minat Torah? So what I have argued is that I think that the justification and the nobility of Mechiras Chametz is based on the following idea. That we have a Yisr in the Torah to own Chametz on Pesach. So why is there such an Yisr? So that's an interesting question. Why is that the case, that there is such an Yisr to own Chametz on Pesach? So the Ran, in the beginning of Maseches Pesachim, suggests that this is essentially a siag min haTorah. I think we've talked about, certainly last year we talked about this a lot, I think this year we talked about this a little bit, comes up every once in a while, that there are dinim in the Torah itself that act as if they're derabbanans, that are protective of other mitzvahs. We know that dinim derabbanan are generally there to protect a mitzvah min haTorah. But it could be that there are mitzvahs in the Torah itself that serve that same function. And Rav Yosef Engel, the great Talmudist, in his essays in the Sefer Lekach Tov in Klal Ches, has a whole discussion about this. Do we ever find anywhere in the Torah where there is a din d'oraisa, but its function is like a din d'rabbanan? It's there to protect other dinim in haTorah. So he says, think about it for a minute. He comes up with 17, 18 examples. So one of the examples, very explicit, almost all the examples you have to take one view and Rishonim, it's not unanimous examples. But one of the more prominent examples is this Ran in the beginning of Maseches Pesachim, that the Ran says, that why is it the Torah prohibits us to own chametz? So it says it's really a siag, that really there isn't any timei hamitzvahs reason why we should not own chametz on Pesach. Really the issur is to eat chametz on Pesach. But we're concerned that if you own chametz, so you're going to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're going to be hungry and you're going to make yourself a peanut butter sandwich. So we don't say that you're not allowed to own pork. Right? Why don't we say that that should be usher by other things as well? So there's two differences. One is that pork is allowed and chametz is an isakari, so it's a more serious prohibition. But also, more practically speaking, that let's say for whatever reason you have pork in your fridge, but you never eat pork. So even if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're hungry, you're very unlikely to make yourself a pork sandwich. But you do eat chametz 51 weeks a year. So if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you come down to the fridge and you're all drowsy and you see a loaf of bread there, there's a good possibility that you'll make yourself a peanut butter sandwich. So essentially, what does the Ran say? That we're worried that you're going to come to eat chametz on Pesach. So the Torah said, as a siag min haTorah, you shouldn't even own chametz at all. So if that's the goal of Bal Yirah, Bal Yimatzeh, perhaps we could say that there are two things we can do to keep us from eating chametz on Pesach. One is we could simply not have access to any. We don't own any, and that will keep us away. Or we could do something else. That if the chametz was in our house, but, and that, by the way, is also a point of controversy, that there was some of the earlier sources discussed in the Mechiras Chametz that wasn't in the house, that they assumed the condition of the Mechiras Chametz was that you would physically take it somewhere else. That's not the way we do things nowadays.
In Ramat Shlomo a couple years ago when they tried that.
Right, yes. Right. Yeah. So, but, again, that's what he pays. But in any event, so that's not the way we do things nowadays, is for the most part, most of us sell our chametz and we keep it in our house. But if it's kept in the house, that's theoretically possible too, because we are so concerned about the Isser of Gezel. We believe so strongly in the din of Losigzel that if the chametz belongs to somebody else, so then we are equally confident that we are not going to eat the chametz. Hi.
If it's just a siyag to keep you from eating it, wouldn't, like, I don't know, maybe if you ship your chametz to China, but you maintain ownership of it. Are you locking?
Yeah, in general, there is a whole sugya of what is the Yisra Bayira Bayimatse? Why is it there's two Yisra Bayira Bayimatse? Does it perhaps cover two different types of ownership? You know, does one refer to the chametz you will actually encounter, and one the chametz that is matzui or nirushus? It's a little bit of an involved sugya. It's a fair question. It's a little bit complicated. But there's what to say based on that. To what exactly is the Yisra Torah of ownership of chametz in the language of Bal Yira, Bal Yimatzei? Neither one is a word straight out that means ownership. It seems to specifically describe chametz that you are likely to come across or to see. And how does that affect the gather of the Yisra? It's a fair question. It's a little bit of a different sugya. Hi.
So if you sell your chametz, mm-hmm. right, do you have to put it away?
Yeah, you certainly should keep it in a way, in a place that's not on your table, you know, that's not in immediate access, because we're still worried that if, even though you're allowed to have the chametz of a non-Jew in your house, but if you're still not allowed to eat the chametz of a non-Jew, right?
So are you not allowed to go to the supermarket on Facebook?
No, you are, because that chametz is not yours, and you know it's not yours. So there's no chance.
Yeah, but you sold this, so it's not yours either.
Yes, but if you you have to have it identifiable that it's not yours. If you leave this loaf of bread the same way it's on your breakfast table every day.
I'm saying, let's say it's put in a certain area, like you put all the chametz in a certain area. Do you have to cover it?
Well, it should be. Yeah, basically, you should make it clear and identifiable that it's off limits. If it's left in your house the same way that other food is left in your house, then that's a big risk, because even though you can have chametz of an akum in your house, but you can't eat the chametz of an akum. So that if you're going to leave it in your house in a way that's not obviously different than the way you normally have food in your house, it's certainly a tremendous michshol. That's certainly not what we're looking for. Hi.
So, separate question somewhere what he was saying, but not exactly. Mm-hmm. Let's say, for me, I have an apartment here in the Heights. Is there any, if I'm selling the chametz, is there any rules I need to know for cleaning up or...
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. There's also Bedikas Chametz. We'll get to that maybe as we get a little bit closer to Pesach, which before we run out of time today, just to finish this point. So perhaps the assumption can be made that we have such a adherence to the rules of Choshen Mishpat, as we're learning this year, to the rules of Lo Sigzol, that we are confident that if the Chametz that's in our house belongs to someone else, and it is subject to Gzela, if we would take it, that will also keep us away from Chametz. And that's a tremendous statement, saying we're willing to stake our kares on our respect for mamonis. That even though there's an isser kares on eating chametz, that's not necessarily enough to keep us away. But our respect for the property of others and for those sigzol, that will keep us away. And that's perhaps a particularly relevant message when it comes to Pesach, that the Smag has a famous line where he says, in Pesach we talk about geula, about the past geula and the future geula. So the Smag says that we can't expect there's going to be a geula as long as there is a reputation that the Jews don't deal honestly in business, that they're not people of integrity. So then you can't expect there's going to be a geula, because the Chil Hashem, the nations of the world, will say, why is God redeeming this nation that's all corrupt, that's made up of gazlanim? But if it's known that the Jews are people who are people of integrity and people of honesty, so then God can bring a geula. It's not going to be a Chil Hashem, it'll be a Kiddush Hashem. So perhaps particularly on Pesach, when it's a time we focus on past and future geulas, so we go out of our way to enter into a transaction with Umas Olam and to show how much we value the integrity of that transaction and to make sure not to violate it throughout the course of Pesach, throughout the course of the term of the transaction. So the fact that they don't actually eat it or that they give it back after Pesach does not affect that ki hu zeh. It doesn't matter what happens afterwards. It doesn't matter whether or not they actually choose to eat it. It just matters that you, during the course of Pesach, value and honor the fact that it's subject to those things, all that even if it's just technically someone's else, as opposed to being brought into their position, that technically is enough to create the Yisra Lo Sigzol, and that's enough to do what has to be done. So along those lines, though, it's very important that it is treated as completely off limits for that reason. So sometimes there are cases where it's reasonable to say there is a mechila, that the purchaser is allowing you to use it under these circumstances. I think it's important that those should be clarified in advance with explicit mechila, and you shouldn't be too quick to assume mechila, because that undermines the whole attitude that we're working off here, that we don't allow ourselves to be too flexible with the chametz, and that we assume it's really off limits because it's not ours. So, for example, it comes up Erev Pesach Chalios B'Shabbos when you have to work out an arrangement to sell all your other chametz, but you still maintain, let's say, two rolls, so you can have Shabbos morning, you can have Suda. So it should be explicitly discussed with the purchaser that there's this very small amount that you're leaving out of the sale. But even if you could make the case that he's going to be mochel on something like that, it might be true, but that attitude is not helpful towards the attitude that Mechiras Chametz is supposed to represent. So if it's at all possible, even in a circumstance where Mechila may be a reasonable assumption, it still should be clarified and made explicit as part of the deal that this is and if there is any other reason where, let's say, there's other chametz that there's some halachic justification to use, and you're going to premise on mechila, should really say to him straight out that there's chametz that we may need access to, and will you allow us that access? Because it shouldn't be just taken for granted, because the mindset really should be that the chametz is not yours, and there is gezeila involved, and should be off limits. So there's a lot more to say about the Mechiras Chametz, but that's the yesod, I think, and that what guides us in terms of both hashkafically and halachically in understanding some of these principles. Hi.
I think last year we discussed the hard tzvi about if you find on Pesach, so
yeah, a lot of folks will talk about that.
Damaging, but if we say that the nature of it is sort of that he just has a chov on this, so you can have a nezek on a chov.
No, okay, he owns it completely. He has a chov on the money.
He has a chov on the money, okay.
Yeah, so the money, he owns it completely.
Which would be exchanged for the thing which he really owns.
Right, so he owns it. Again, that's a crucial understanding. That the Shiloh that Jonathan's talking about, Shiloh, a lot of posts can talk about, it always happens every year to somebody, that they find in the closet a bottle of whiskey that they forgot about, something like that. So now the Shiloh is, what's the status of that? So there are posts who will say you should destroy it because maybe it wasn't part of the sale, so it's subject to Bali Rav, Bali Matzah, it's from the Shalom of Pesach. I'm very hesitant to say like that, and there are others who agree as well, that think there's a chashash gzeila, that there's a chashash that it belongs to the non-Jew. And the fact that it wasn't in the closet that you sold, I don't think that's a problem. That when you sell the chametz and you identify, okay, the chametz is in the basement in this closet, etc., etc., that's a mar makom. That you're telling him so that he should be able to find it when he wants to come and get it. So you tell him where most of the chametz is. But it does not mean to say that I'm only selling the chametz in these areas. The shtar that we use, those of us that take a look at the shtar that you might be using, but the shtar that we use sells, I sell all the chametz that's in my possession. Now, where do you want to find the chametz? Where is the chametz that you bought? So I'll tell you, it's here, it's there, here's how you get to it, etc., etc. But that identification is a mar makom. It's not meant to limit the sale to those chametzes. So if it turns out that you find chametz in your reshus that you didn't have in those sections of the house, don't think that means that the sale is not valid, is not affecting that. That chametz is also sold. So I think there's more likely than not that the chametz belongs to a non-Jew, and therefore there's a chashash gezeila. So again, so take the attitude, well, yeah, it's his, but he's probably moichel if I destroy it because I'm machmer here. It's a good question if he's been moichel on a bottle of whiskey. But I think that attitude is not one. I'd rather err on the side of not acting too casually with his property. If one really wants to be machmer, so then he could wait till after. He could put it now with the soul chametz and identify it or whatever. And then after Pesach, when he gets it back, okay, he wants to spill it out down the drain. Gesunte, hey, maybe a Baal Tashkus at that point, it won't be the Gzela. So I think that that's a ramification of this whole understanding. Hi.
But then what's the point, if the nature of the contract is that anything in my rishus at all, so what would be the point at all of doing a bittel, kol chavir and everything?
Yeah, because he's not going to, it's a good question. It could be that then it becomes both, that we're basically has two different types of chametz that we're addressing. Now, the chametz that's actually usable, that he may want to buy, so then that's sold to him, and then the chametz that is not findable.
It does only on like crumbs and stuff.
Yeah, it's a discussion in general what it goes, and that's part of the whole question of the Bechor Shor, but it could be that in practice it's a safeguard for both. Right, there are much more, there's much more to say about this. We'll see how much more time we'll give to it. I kind of shot to the end of that episode. So at least if we don't get to say more about it, we'll say that. But we didn't get to know it all. So I really know things. So God willing, next Sunday, we'll chazal that and we'll talk about the schedule.